Hello, everybody. JJ Cooper, Jeff Ponce, Ian Kundle, Baseball America Prospect Podcast, and it's a little bit of a different one today. So we've got a lot of trade deadline stuff up at baseballamerica.com. Talked about the trade deadline a lot on the Hot Sheet Show, and want to give you all a sneak peek. Check it out. We're going to go live on YouTube, also on Twitter, but really YouTube is the best place to check it out. You can leave comments, ask your questions, propose trades. We're going to go live, Ian and I, with Jacob Rudner, are going to go live. Jeff, you're invited too. I don't know if we talked to you about it, but you're welcome to join us if you're not busy. But we're going to go live this Wednesday. So as you're downloading this on Wednesday, the day it goes out, you can check it out, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. We're going to talk trade deadline. We're going to, we like going live. We know that a lot of you all like us going live. So we're going to do that, talk trade deadline. So today, a little different on this. We're going to talk. We got a top 100 prospects update coming next week. We'll talk about the actual update next week on the show, the podcast. But this week, we're going to talk about kind of the state of where the top 100 is right now. And I say that in part because, for one thing, we don't have to worry about giving away anything as far as the new top 100. We haven't met on it yet. The big meeting is tomorrow as we record this on Tuesday. So we don't know who's going to be number one. We don't know what changes are going to be in the 10. We've talked about it some. We're doing reporting on it. But I just kind of wanted to roll into this kind of like, because this is a conversation that we've had. I know I've had it with both of you guys and some others on the staff. So I'm just going to ask the simple question. Jeff, I'll start with you. How good is the top 100 right now? Is it an above average top 100? Is it a below average? Is it an average? Is it, we'll figure that out. But, you know, what do you think kind of where the state of the 100 is right now?
I think a lot of this is just a reflection on how long you've been doing this. And have you reached that point where you're just jaded? So, you know, I feel like it's a fine top 100. I personally feel like maybe some of the top end talent we saw last year, we've seen in previous years, was a little bit better. I like Made a lot, but I can think of comparable prospects who are ranked 3 and 4, in recent top 100 lists. So I would say that if I had to put a grade on it, it would be like a 45, maybe a 50 if you're feeling positive. There's some updates, some players that are off the list that I probably have on my own. Some other guys that I think we got to be aggressive in moving up. So I think a 45-50 is kind of reasonable right now. I think maybe the depth is the strength more so than like it being really top heavy, where I felt at points in time last season and then particularly in the offseason, I think you can look at our top three and really our top 10 overall from last year and be like, yeah, there was some more top end talent there. So I think just like comparatively, it's not the worst top 100 we've had. There was a few years ago where we were really struggling to like come up with a number one prospect. And I think it was James Wood that went up to the top of the list. It's not like that. I didn't find myself like adding the draftees always helps. It makes it a little deeper. It's easier to rank because you have some of these guys that you maybe like that are coming into pro ball. And at this point, it's beautiful because they haven't done anything bad or good. So you're kind of just going off of what their amateur profile is and maybe how Carlos and some others kind of view them historically. So it's not as bad as maybe it's the worst of the ones that I've seen over my 5 to 6 years here. But yeah, this is solid, but not great or bad.
Okay. Ian, I'll give you a slightly different question because I think I don't want to, we kind of agree. You know, if you disagree with any of that assessment, feel free to share that. But the other question I'd ask you is what are the, I'll lay it out that I feel like the strength of this 100 right now, if you're comparing it to recent hundreds, is there are years where we get to this point of the year and I'm like, God, I are stretching at 95 to find guys who you want to really put on the list. I feel like I've got another 10, 15, 20 guys I'd be very comfortable putting on this 100 who aren't on it right now. We've got guys who are off of it currently who were on it that were like, when we do this update, they're absolutely going back on. is the, where do you think is the strength of this 100? And is the top, like on what Jeff said, is that kind of where this is a little lacking compared to some other years?
Yeah, I think that there's two real strengths for me. And I think the first one is, I don't think there are any of the elite prospects we've seen in the past years. There's no Connor Griffin level player. There's no even Kevin McGonigal level player in this 100 right now, in my opinion. I think though what there is, and this is a strength, is I think from Jesus Mate down to getting down to even like Sebastian Walcott at 21, I think are all guys that I think you could make a case for around, you know, like top 10, back of the top 10. They don't, there isn't that top, you know, two or three guys like we've seen in past years. Even last year, JJ Weatherholt, I think, was number three. Like he would be the clear number one in this list for me. But I think the 1 to 20 group in itself is actually really deep. And I like a lot of the names in there. And there's guys, as I said, going down, even Sebastian Walcott, who I think you could make a case for should be a consideration for the top 10. I think the other strength is exactly what you said. I think the back of the list is really, is in a really good spot right now in terms of the number of names we have for it. I look at, you know, going starting in like, you know, the 80s and the 90s. And then, as you said, there's 10, 15, even 20 guys who we don't have on it that I think are in consideration. I think that kind of sums up what the strengths of the minors are right now is, you know, there's a lot of guys who between, and there's not a lot of difference either. And I think that's something that kind of gets lost because we cut it off at 100. But if you wanted to tell me that the, you know, the guy that we have at 110 right now should be inside the top 100, I don't think any of us would dispute that. You know, I don't think it's a pretty flat level there. I don't know where it, you know, it probably starts in like the 70s or something and then goes down to 125, 130. You know, all those guys could easily be on the back of the list. So I think that's the strength. The weakness for me is the middle part. I look at the guys we have in the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, and there are some that I would have much lower than we have them currently. And there's just not a lot of names in there that I look at and I'm like, I would move these guys up.
Can I call out one specific demographic that I think we're maybe talking around? So why not just throw it out there? It's the college pitchers outside of Cade Anderson from last year. It's Liam Doyle, which is like there were bright spots at points where like I wanted to be optimistic. I think you get into late July, early August, and you're less optimistic. It's Jamie Arnold and it's Tyler Bremner, who I don't think has really been bad, but just been used kind of interestingly. But am I wrong?
Right. No, you're right.
Those are guys that I feel like you have. And I think some of this is like ranking dynamics, right? And I feel like between this and fantasy and the top 25 college and then FY, like I'm always doing rankings, right? It's a trustworthy demographic. It's a demographic that typically, regardless of how good the player development is in a given organization, typically college starters go fairly good, yeah, especially if they're highly touted, if they have success in big conferences and have decent stuff. They kind of checked all those boxes in different ways between Bremner, Doyle, and Arnold, but they all had unique traits that I think coming out of the draft, we all could buy in on. Those guys typically get shut down. And if they pitch like Doyle did after the draft, you kind of take it with a grain of salt. I mean, like, look at what Paul Skeens did after the draft and like what he is now. Right. But they haven't delivered this year in a way that I think justifies what their preseason rank was. And those are tough rankings to kind of move down in the first half of the season, frankly, because things can change pretty quick with a tweak or something like that.
Well, and that's why I think what's so hard about draftees these days and like slotting them in is a lot of the pitchers, when we're setting our initial 100 in the offseason, they've never pitched in pro ball. So we're just going off of amateur data. And these pitchers, and over the winter, these pitchers, a lot of them will completely transform. And I think, you know, the best examples of the last 2 years are probably a pair of Red Sox guys in Peyton Tolley and Anthony Ianson, who were one pitcher, you know, both of them second and third round picks respectively. They came into pro ball and they were just completely different pitchers. And Tolley obviously has ascended and is now, you know, looking on a path to be maybe a number two starter in the big leagues. And Ianson, while he hasn't held his velocity gains, his secondary stuff has improved across the board. He's added a new pitch and a cutter. And even though his number, he's not putting up the gaudy numbers that Tolley did. He's putting up more walks. He's not going as deep into games. He still had a very, very good season, shown that he can be an effective pitcher while sitting, you know, 93 to 95. And I think that it makes it hard because, you know, as you, Jeff, said, those college pitchers, you know, they all come in with big expectations, all top 10 picks, and they just haven't really, you know, you talk to scouts and it's like, I like them, but I don't love them. And it's like, well, that's not what you want to hear for a top 10 pick. And I think that is definitely a part of it, that it's, you know, when you get in that middle tier, you were hoping some of those guys would take a step forward. And frankly, if you had to ask me who the top three pitchers from last year's draft class are, Cade Anderson's obviously number one. There's no doubt. I don't think it's crazy to say that Anthony Hines and Gage Wood are probably two and three in some
college pitchers.
College. I should say my college.
I would say Seth Hernandez, we can argue.
Yes. Meant to say college pitchers. I was thinking about college pitchers, but yeah, like and you look at
and yell at you.
Yes. Yeah. I know we love Seth Hernandez here. As you can see on the screen, he's our number seven prospect for a reason. But yeah, I think it's Cade Anderson, Anthony Hines, and Gage Wood. I think you can make the case have been the three most successful. And like you talk to scouts, like Gage Wood, non-zero chance he pitches in the big leagues this year. Like there's really interesting stuff going on with them, but it just hasn't balanced out when you lose three top 10 picks who have not lived up to expectations.
Can I throw out one other thing with this though? That's like true of college pitchers is like the difficult thing, and again, fun, difficult. No one's complaining here about, oh, woe is us. We have to rank prospects for a living. It's really fun. But one of the challenging things of this, with especially when it comes to pitchers, but especially these college pitchers, right, is, as you all just laid out, you're talking right now about guys who are in the situation where they're adjusting to a new schedule in a lot of cases, mm-hmm. because I know like some teams now are even in the minors will do it for a while, but at some point you're going to make that transition for, wait, I've got to start now, a day earlier than I did before, right? You're now part of a five-man rotation as opposed to I pitch on Fridays or I pitch on Saturdays. So you've got that. You've got the different baseball. You know, you've got all these things. But the other part of it is it's a journey, right? Like, I one of the things that strikes me is that with pitchers, especially like hitters, a lot of times the best hitting prospects, their minor league paths are pretty linear, right? Like, there's no point where you look at Kevin McGonigal's minor league path and you're like, yeah, that's when he really went through a dark time and had to really figure out how to kind of respond. A bad month for Kevin McGonigal was a good month, right? If you think about this, though, for even elite pitching prospects, there are not many Paul Skeens out there, right? Like, Jacob Mizorowski is the best pitcher in baseball now, I would argue. I saw Jacob Mizorowski in a whole lot of, you know, spring breakout game hadn't been around that long, but it was multiple years. And it was not something where it was like, stop everything. I mean, you knew that you were going to see really good stuff, but it wasn't something where you were always watching him and going like, I'm watching the guy who's going to be the greatest pitcher in the game before long. If you go down a further level, like there are a number of guys where you look at it and it's like, yeah, that was their lost year, right? Mackenzie Gore is not, you know, is a solid big league pitcher now. Mackenzie Gore had a stretch where he was a truly horrendous minor league pitcher. I'm talking the stuff was gone, the control was gone, the delivery was gone, everything was gone. And then he put it back together. The tough thing when we talk about these college pitchers, especially this first year, Jamie Arnold does not look like what you want to see right now in a first round pitcher from last year. Okay. And then now the challenge is how much of that is this is who he is, and how much of that is this is who he is right now. And now he's going to have to learn how to adjust, how to make that transition. Go ahead, Ian.
Well, I think that's why it's important to remember that whenever we do these rankings, they're just a snapshot in time. You know, they are going to change because prospect development is not linear. And in the given moment, I don't think it's, you know, say, you know, for example, Jamie Arnold or, you know, that he, so right now, yes, as you said, he's not the same pitcher he looked like in college, but that's not to say he couldn't get back there as you were alluding to with those other examples of like Mackenzie Gore, Jacob Mizorowski, players like that. Obviously we're not saying he's going to live up to that level, but you know, if he came out next year and started throwing more strikes, had, you know, more consistent velo, things like that, that wouldn't be a surprise at all. And that's why, and if he does that, we'll adjust, which is why, you know, we do these updates, is because with development right now, there's just, I think it's more so on the pitcher side, as you said, there's just the things evolve so quickly. You know, guys can just go in and you see them in April and then you come back and see them over the summer and all of a sudden they've added a completely new pitch or they've changed a new pitch grip and they found something with it that's unlocked. They've, you know, tweaked their delivery a little bit. I know someone we talked about, you and I have, and you've written about is Ben Jacobs, who, you know, made a very small tweak to his delivery to get more extension and more drive off his backside or back leg. And as a result, he all of a sudden added more velo and was able to shoot up to, I think he's in high A right now. Like little things like that can make such a big difference for a pitcher. And that's why it's like, you have to be constantly ready to evolve and ready to adjust depending on what those guys do. And it might seem like yo-yoing, but at the same time, it's just because of how finicky the development is with them. You know, things can change on the drop of a dime.
We're going to talk about this a little bit more, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the things that we've learned from past top 100s. We'll do that right after this quick break.
Big second half of the season coming up. There might be a hot ticket, a rivalry series, a sold out experience that you need to get your hands on. And SeatGeek is the spot for that. You can find good pricing. They help you with the pricing. Green dot, good. Red dot, not as good. And they help you with your view of the seat for some big matchups coming up in August, September, and eventually leading up to playoffs.
Why would you not use SeatGeek? If you want to view from your seat, you want to know if it's a good seat, if it's a good deal, it has all of it on the app. It's easy to use. It's one click, boom. You buy the tickets, they send them right to you, you get them on the app, and then you can go check out whatever game, whatever you're a fan of, you can go to, whether it's baseball, whether it's concerts, whatever you're into, you can find a ticket, and you can always try to find the green dot on SeatGeek.
And for MLB tickets, you can get 10% off with that promo code we're running all season long, Territory10, that's Territory10 off your next set of MLB tickets at SeatGeek. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so you can use it later.
And we're back. I think that that's a really good point that Ian's making there, Jeff, which is like one of the, again, we're talking about process a lot this week, but one of the challenges of this that we want to get better and better at is not, okay, I think there's a misconception, understandably, I would say out there from some people, you know, I've had comments about this, like you see the hot sheet and you're like, oh, they're just reacting to who's had a great week. Yes, on the hot sheet, we are. The hot sheet is entirely designed to be, we're going to talk about prospects who had a great week or of having a great little stretch. And that, and then we'll get the same, they'll get the opposite questions are, which is, this guy's been in the hot sheet 3 weeks in a row. How's he not on the top 100? And it's like, because the hot sheet and the top 100 are two very different things. One is rewarding prospects having great performance, and the other is looking much more bigger picture at which prospects are going to perform in the big leagues. And Jeff, I kind of will tee up you on this, which is we're always trying to react to tangible, significant information without overreacting to this guy had a bad start, this guy hit 7 home runs in 6 games, you know, like things that are fascinating in the moment, but are not really a big deal in the long run. I feel like that's a little easier now. Like we have more underlying information that makes it a lot better than when it was just like that, none of that existed. But how do you see, like, how do we balance? Like, again, we're trying to like really reflect our reporting, our analysis, all that. And when we move guys up and down, but how do you kind of balance that?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a matter of a few things. And I think just naturally within our process, we have checks and balances built in. And I know this is going to sound very Baseball America centric and probably somewhat arrogant, but I think that's what differentiates us between what we do and a lot of other sites. And I don't know everybody's process, but I speak to that just based on the type of information we have. I know other people don't necessarily have, and just how aggressive we are throughout the year of soliciting feedback on our personal, like our top 30 list, let's say personal, but really our top 30, like system-based list. And then that obviously feeds its way into the top 100. And then we're sending out the top 100. Maybe more often than not, it's less scout, based stuff where guys that have specific systems, like their input kind of filters its way into the list through our top 30s. And then we're sort of sending this out, at least from the feedback loop, we're sending this out to maybe analysts that have you know, a wider net, a larger perspective on like the universe of players at large. We're sending it to general managers, scouting directors, AGMs, front office people, in positions of power, guys that are hitting buttons and making decisions. And we get a lot of feedback. And I feel like you tend to get kind of some consistency within that. Not to say that there aren't players that certain teams and certain executives are higher on than others. But I think when you see a prospect trending up, we tend to get that feedback from that part of sort of the feedback loop, right? Then we filter in all of the underlying data that impacts our 30s, it impacts our personal rankings, how we feel about these players. That goes into some of the top 100 conversation. It's stuff that's brought up before the list is made. When we're on a call, we'll be doing one tomorrow. We'll be on for hours. We will have conversations where, you know, some of that underlying data that is non-public is very heavily weighted within the decision, right? And I think, you know, like a perfect example of this might be somebody like an Eric Hartman, who moved up quite a bit on our list and really was way down on the Braves list. And that was, you know, no knock on Carlos or his work in the offseason. There were significant changes. And that's going to happen more often than not with an 18, 19, 20-year-old player. And you're more willing to buy into sustainable changes with players at that age because so much is still developing. Once you're 22, 23 years old, it gets a little harder to kind of change your profile and what you do and don't do well. But there are significant contact gains, approach gains, power gains. Angles, I think you can see for a longer period of time get adjusted, but there kind of has to be a baseline to believe it. And I'm getting a little bit off topic now. But we saw what Hartman was doing. The underlying data backed it. We had conversations with scouts that backed it. We had conversations with front office people that backed it, right? So that's somebody that, you know, will continue to, you know, move up our list. And there might be other players who were ranked much higher coming into the year. But as we start to get into that underlying data, we start to look at, you know, the feedback from scouts. We start to look at the feedback from front office people. So I guess all this to say, that's not to say that we're not looking at performance, but it has to be performance that's backed by belief and backed by underlying data that says, yes, this is sustainable historically, because we've been looking at underlying data like this now for 6 or 7 years. And it's like, okay, historically, this compares to Gunnar Henderson or Corbin Carroll or like these other guys that, you know, checked all those boxes and have gone on to significant big league success. Because at the end of the day, we don't rank on how you perform in the minor leagues. We're ranking based on how we think you're going to perform in the major leagues at peak. So I think that's the balance of players who are performing versus what is this player going to be at 26 years old in the major leagues? Because it could take some time to adjust too. I think we see that with players. So, you know, we're looking more toward like peak value. What is this guy going to be? And what are the things, the tools, the abilities, you know, historically, like do players get to that point that are like this? And I think, you know, your article today looking at some of these power hitters probably ties into that a little bit.
So that's also kind of part of this is that we also all try to, like, we bring our own viewpoints to this. I mean, again, like to go to what Jeff said there, one of the things I think is very valuable about this is that we all have things that are kind of our archetype of player, I would say. I will always wear that, like, when it comes to pitchers, if you're a soft tosser, I don't care about you. I don't, unless you can learn how to throw hard. Because you know what? I know that there are a million people out there who want it to be true that the best way to be a great pitcher in the big leagues is to be really crafty and you're going to hit your spots perfectly and all. And they're going to cite Greg Maddux and they're going to cite players who've been gone long enough that they are now in their 50s and sitting there in gray, you know, at the Hall of Fame, you know, and all. But in the modern game, it's just the reality that throwing hard is really important. And if you look at, if you ask the question of who are the best pitchers in baseball right now, one of the key things about them, Cam Schlittler went from being nothing to being a stud. Why? Not because he learned how to command the ball better. He learned that he could throw a fastball 99 miles an hour instead of 93. And when it was 99, it plays a lot better than 93. That's a bias I have. Other people look at it differently. When it comes to like the piece I did today, again, we're trying to, we love the questions when people are like, why is Andrew Fisher not on the 100? Why is, you know, this guy not higher up? And a lot of times it is power hitters and what we've kind of seen. Like, again, when you say about historical data, flawed power hitters are kind of one of those things that's one of the toughest things to rank, right? Because every now and then one of them's going to become a stud. And a lot of times they're going to be, oh, remember that guy, you know? Like, I remember watching Russ Brandian, who's been long, long, long retired. But Russ Brandian was a guy who's like, if he could ever figure out how to make more contact, he could be 50 homers a year. And it's 100% true. And he never figured out how to make more contact. But Ian, kind of when we're looking at this, when we're diving into this, Jeff mentioned Hartman. The other thing that's a challenge with this is that we don't want to forget what we've known before or the perceptions of before. But like, I think that Josiah Hartshorne is a good example of this. You and I both obviously saw him at the Futures game. The way I would put this is this. Josiah Hartshorne and Ethan Holliday, like if we would be talking 2 years ago, I don't think there'd be any way that you say Josiah Hartshorne is a better prospect than Ethan Holliday. And at this point, I know Ethan Holliday's been hurt this year, but you've seen them both play this year. I would find it hard to believe at this point that Ethan Holliday is going to be a better big leaguer than Josiah Hartshorne. I think that Josiah Hartshorne, neither of them are going to have a ton of defensive value at the end of the day, probably. Ethan Holliday may hit the ball slightly harder, but I mean, it's slight. But I just think Josiah Hartshorne has a much better hit tool, and that's going to be, at the end of the day, probably an overriding kind of thing. But like, that's an example of something where it's like, you don't want to throw away what you thought you knew in the past, but you also want to react to what you're seeing now, what you're reporting, what the data, all of it puts together. Like, is that one that jumps out to you, or is there someone else that stands out?
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good example. Cause yeah, it is, and it's one of those things that I think is part of what's important about our process is like, we're combining those in-person looks with both on the pro side and the amateur side. So we came in, you know, I did not see Ethan Holliday as an amateur, obviously, but we have people on staff who did, who had that, you know, built-in track record with him that were able to, you know, I was able to bounce things off because I went out to California earlier in the season and was able to see him before he got hurt for an entire series. And he did some things really well. He had a couple home runs. It's all fields power. It might be 70 raw power. Like he hits the ball extremely hard. It's a very, very unique swing and very uphill. And the result is he has trouble accessing certain pitch types. Fastballs 95 plus above the belt, had a lot of trouble getting to. Breaking balls and changeups down in the zone, a lot of trouble like recognizing and getting to, and things like that. And, you know, when you see that happening, the same pitch is kind of getting spammed him over and over again, and you swing through them, then he'll mix in a home run. You know, that can be a tough look to kind of eval it. Whereas you look at someone like Hartshorne, who we've seen this year, he was a sixth round pick. Granted, got way over slot. I think he got around second round money. Comes from a really big school in California. I got to talk to him at the Futures game. And it was really interesting hearing his story about, you know, he had access to a lot of the same technology Ethan Holliday did growing up. Because Ethan Holliday, obviously coming from the Holliday family, they have that whole, you know, the batting cage, the full setup with all the, you know, the hit scan or the hit tracks, all that stuff. Josiah Hartshorne's high school had all that stuff too. And he got into pro ball though. And it's just, you know, being able to focus on baseball every day and being able to go out there and just hit has just really translated. And we saw it in the Futures game. You know, I don't think he got a hit, but he had some really good at bats. He put a great swing on one of the better fastballs in the game and lining it out. I want to say it was either to right field or center field too. And yeah, you know, you combine that performance, what he's done in low A, high A, the way he's translated against better competition, better pitching than what Holliday was seeing in the California League. And then ultimately health, like that stuff matters too. Someone like Hartshorne is going to end up playing a full season, whereas Holliday is going to miss, you know, what, 4 months, 5 months of reps this season. That's a lot for someone who's at you know, in the early stages of their career. And it puts him behind the eight ball heading in next season. It's not to say that Holiday can't make these adjustments, because another player who missed a ton of time, Ethan Salas, was someone I talked to at the Futures game. He talked about how during the season he missed, he was still able to develop in his mind positively because he was putting in the work off the field in other areas. You know, he couldn't play, but there were still ways that you can develop. And that's going to be a key for Holiday too, especially given, just, you know, the injury and everything that's going on right now.
So kind of along those lines, Jeff, how do you try to, again, I think people would be interested to know, how do you try to separate out when you're getting conflicting inputs on a player, right? So all the time, like, we will get examples of, okay, we've gotten feedback that we're too high on this guy and we're too low on him, right? Some people say we're too high. Some people say we're too low, which is often like a Goldilocks, like, okay, so we're kind of just right. you know, because again, the great thing about this is there aren't answers, right? Like, Ian and I were talking yesterday, and one thing I would say that when it comes to prospects are not, do not think like a light switch, right? This is not on, this has a prospect, off, he's not. Think of a rotary dial that goes from like 1 to 10, right? And when people kind of wonder, well, why do guys move up and down? Like, you're just moving them just to juice the rankings. Like, no, what we're trying to do is sometimes you have the input you have on a prospect kind of tells you he's a 5, he's a 4. Then you get more feedback. Then they start doing something differently, and now they're a 6. And then they get injured. And, you know, like Bryce Rainer this year, it's like, he's a, you know, we didn't knock him off the 100, but like, if you'd have asked any of the three of us in March, watching that swing, like, what is Bryce Rainer going to do in April? We'd been like, he's probably going to be one of the worst hitters in the minor leagues. And like, if you were just taking a snapshot, he was a 2 at that point. But we're like, he's got problems in his swing coming back from an injury, shoulder injury. He'll probably get him fixed. He has now. Okay, back up to a 6 or a 7. Like, it's kind of like, it's all on a spectrum. You're turning the knob. Like, what? But again, you're trying not to overreact because you know that the underlying process, you know, the underlying tools are there. But you're also trying not to underreact where you don't acknowledge, like, hey, Bryce Rainer may not get back to this. I know, Ian, looked like you have something you wanted to add to that.
Yeah, no, it got me thinking about something that happened to me this past week where I was talking to a couple scouts I know were at the same series all week. And so I was, you know, just kind of running through what they thought of some guys in it. And there was one specific player where they gave 2 wildly different grades on. And this is a player that both of them watched the exact same set of games and came away with 2 completely different opinions of a player. And that's, you know, I think that's the ultimate example of what you were talking about, is like, you know, we'll get up arrow down feedback, but you can see in the industry, 2 people whose jobs, you know, these are guys who are paid to scout professional baseball. They go in and they watch the same player and have 2 wildly different opinions. And that's, you know, that's where a lot of this comes to. It's not an exact science. You know, a lot of it is, you know, that's why you have to combine all these different points of references and do the reporting in addition to, you know, evaluating the data and everything, is because, you know, you can talk to certain people or certain organizations who prioritize certain archetypes of players. Another org might not like that type of player. You know, there's certain things that are different, that there's just so much variance from organization to organization. And that's what makes it, I think, you know, it makes it so fun, but also, you know, it's challenging when you're coming ultimately to try and determine where to rank someone who one player thinks should be inside the top 100. And the other one's like, yeah, I don't think he's one of the top 10 prospects in the system.
I'd throw this out, Jeff, I'll kind of tee you up on this, because it's the guy we've all talked about. We're going to have a fun discussion, I can tell you right now, probably about Kendry Churio. Not because there's anyone who's going to be in that virtual room tomorrow who's like, Kendry Churio sucks. No one would say that, right? This is a guy who, as a teenager, is dominant, who throws hard, checks my box on that. You know, those things where you're like, okay, this is why he could be really good. But he's a tough one to rank because he's also not physically impressive. Like, you know, like, it doesn't mean you can't be a successful pitcher and be small, but he's small. And there are like, so like, he's a pitcher. So the fact that he's so dominant at high A, at an age where many of his contemporaries are figuring out rookie ball or trying to get to low A, doesn't mean the same thing for that as it does if you're a hitter, right? Like, is he like you've been, I know you've spent a lot of time thinking about Churio. Like, there are guys like that where it's like, we're not trying to be Debbie Downer, but it's like, calm down just a little bit. And we could be wrong, but here's why we're trying to be a little bit hesitant on a guy like that.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's one of these kind of classic debates over the last few years where, you know, there's performance. You know, I think 10 years ago, we probably would have shoved this guy up into the top 25 because he throws hard enough. He's getting, you know, enough strikeouts. The performance is there. He's young for the level. He's throwing a lot of strikes. So I think from like a traditional sense, he does check a lot of boxes of like a top 50 to top 25 type of prospect. But we've also seen that there are certain traits and characteristics that pitchers kind of need to have in order, and it's beyond just velocity, some release trait characteristics. You know, that could be extension. It could be sort of how the arm action comes at you. You know, could be kind of spin efficiency. I think that's probably more of a release metric than it even is anything else. Though certainly has a massive impact on ball flight, but where does it come from? And then, you know, like the ball flight metrics. So like, how does the pitch move once it's out of the hand? You know, does it, if it doesn't, so like, I always kind of look at fastballs for years. I've been saying this, I think before I even came to Baseball America, but when I break down a fastball, it's kind of like a triangle of like, does it touch, you know, all three corners? And it's like velocity, most important, that kind of gets you in the door. And I think like that probably has like a 60 to 65, 70% kind of weight on this.
I might vote for 75, but yeah.
Yeah. And then you need either release traits or you need movement. Like there are guys that like, just if you didn't have the release traits and you just looked at vert and HB and velocity, you'd be like, yeah, Jacob DeGrom's fastball doesn't seem that unique. But then you factor in the release traits and it's like, okay, he really checks that second box. And it kind of puts into perspective the movement. And then it's like, all right, this guy's actually touching all three corners. And so I think that's the question with Churio, is I think the velocity is there. From like an execution standpoint, the command is there, the control is there. And that's certainly important. And that sometimes if the secondaries are good enough, like when I move up Fajardo, you know, you'll hear Fajardo in the Cardinal system, this update in the top 30, and maybe he's maybe a back end top 100 guy. He's kind of similar. Like the velocity's okay. The command is really good. But the thing that like sells me on Fajardo is it's an above average to plus changeup, and an above average and maybe plus if he adds a couple more ticks in the next couple of years slider. So like I can buy into that a little bit more because it's like Charlie Morton didn't have a great fastball, but had velocity and command and good secondaries. And that's kind of what allowed Charlie Morton to be so successful for a long time. So I think there's like this sliding scale with pitching, and you kind of need to strike the right balance. That's not to say that, I mean, I think Kendry Churio to everybody is a top 100 prospect. I don't think that's a question. But I do think like getting him into that 50 to like 25 range is a little bit more of a question, because you're like, I don't know if he has those special characteristics that differentiate him from a four to a number three starter to a number four starter versus a guy that's like a number three to a number two or above that, right? Because I think when we look at that mid rotation, we use that mid rotation term, it's kind of like you can hedge one way or the other. It's like mid rotation or like number four or like mid rotation, but there's upside for a two. So I think it's like, he's in that weird range where like, I think he's a 60. I think he's a number three, but it's like, is it the high end three or is it the lower end three? And well, that's going to come down to those characteristics.
To give another example, Ian, of a guy who's not even, I don't think, you know, who's not currently on our 100, but like who's been our minor league pitcher of the year a couple of years ago, Quinn Matthews. I was, you know, looking a couple of days ago, like at minor league leaders. And it's like, Cade Anderson leads the minors in opponents batting average. Second is Quinn Matthews. Matthews has a one ERA in July, had a two ERA in June. Like, this is a guy who's been a prominent prospect, who's shoving, but it kind of goes back to the point that you were making earlier about these guys, you know, we were all making about that this is a journey. It's like Quinn Matthews at his best has looked exceptional. Quinn Matthews has had times where it's like, what happened to Quinn Matthews and where did he go? Now it's back to he looks really good. But it kind of fits into what Jeff was saying also there, where it's like, you also don't want to get too caught up in the moment. Like you're trying, like you just saw, okay, I'll talk about Quinn Matthews. I'll talk about one you wrote about recently. You just saw Carson Milbrandt, right? We just saw, you talked to Carson Milbrandt at the Futures game as well. You all saw Carson Milbrandt on not a very good day for Carson Milbrandt. You're trying to big picture it and at the same time not let what you see, either good or bad, overdo, you know, because again, we also try to watch a lot of this, you know, that's not your first time seeing Carson Milbrandt when you saw him like that. But all of this kind of goes back to the whole idea of with these guys of like, you know, at the end of the day, we're trying to lay out what they're going to be in 5 to 10 years. And that's really challenging, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the hardest things because it's, especially with pitchers, because of just, you know, there's the inherent injury risk, which can just completely change the trajectory of a career. And I mean, you look at the 100 right now, and this was something that, didn't have time to talk about earlier, but there's a lot of like guys coming off of injuries or who are in the midst of injuries in the middle of the list. And that I think is really like complicated things. Like someone like Jarlin Susana, who Jeff and I were talking about him earlier today. We were having some trouble figuring out where to rank him for a different list. Cause it's like, I don't know when he's going to be back. I don't know what he's going to look like.
He's on the mound. I've seen him. He's on the mound again. Yeah. So I'm getting excited.
But that's a high maintenance body who has spent a lot of time off the field. Like, what is that going to look like when he comes back? We don't know. But yeah, I agree that, you know, it makes it very tricky because when when you see a guy in person, like I did Milbrandt, like you have your evaluations, you know, I have my processes for how I'm going to write him up when I'm doing the scouting report. But at the same time, I watched a bunch of his double A starts and he was arguably, you know, in their contention for pitcher of the year if he had stayed in double A. And it's how do you value a guy how much do you take the stock of what a guy did at double A when he was at an age appropriate level first, you know, and then he gets moved up to triple A first time in triple A. He's a high school kid. He's still only 22 years old. How much do you weigh that when, you know, I the lineup we saw him in, and Jeff can attest because Jeff was also there. It's one of the orgiest lineups you're going to see in the sense that it had seven of the nine guys in the lineup had major league experience, was several with like 200 plus plate appearances or even more of major league experience. So he's facing against guys who have like an extensive track record of performance in not only AAA, but also in the big leagues. And he's in his eighth appearance in AAA as a kid who was drafted, you know, 4 years ago out of high school. You know, that's, you have to kind of weigh that too. And which is why I think it just makes it's very difficult with pitchers because there's just so many contextual factors. And the other one, I mean, I think you briefly mentioned earlier too, is the new baseball. You know, when you get up to AAA, you're using a completely different baseball than you've pitched with all season. We've seen the impact that can have. Like someone that comes to mind is Kendry Rojas last year, who has been, looked, I don't know if you've seen what he's been doing in the major leagues recently, looks fantastic. He's throwing just incredible right now. He last year, I believe, had almost as many walks and hits his whip was like 2 in AAA last year. And it all came down to just talking to people with the Twins that he just could not figure out the new baseball. Like he got up there for the first time, was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like the pitchers are not moving the same way. I don't have the same feel for it. And with someone like, you know, Milbrandt, you have to wonder, is that something that's going on? I know when I asked him about it, he said it's a little bit of a factor, not a major one, because he has thrown with it during spring training. But still, like, you know, there's a big difference when you spent the first, you know, 4 months of the season throwing one baseball and you got a new one, and then all of a sudden you're facing better hitters. And so that it's important to understand, I think, the context when we're evaluating these guys, especially the ones that move up in season. I think it applies to position players too. You know, someone like Devin Fitzgerald, who was awesome in high A to start the year, goes up to double A where he's very young for the level and he's really struggled so far. And it's, you know, how much do you weigh his start of the season in high A versus what he's done in double A is something that can be difficult to sift through.
That leads me to a little bit of story time. I've been working a lot on the trade deadline and kind of historical trade deadline moves and all this. And to give it a perfect example of this, like where this is, what makes this endlessly fascinating is you will never master this. I don't care who you are. There's no one, the smartest baseball mind in the world working for a team gets things wrong all the time because we are talking about human beings. Okay, this is a random story time on this, which is looking at the trades, looking at the deals. And one of the things that kind of was a weird one that stood out is in 2010, the White Sox were in it. They were making a push at the deadline, and they were like, we need a starting pitcher. So they went out and they traded for Edwin Jackson, veteran starter who seemed like he got moved at the deadline a lot. And they traded in that deal Daniel Hudson to the D-backs, right? And Edwin Jackson, to his credit, like he was 4-2, 3-2-4, and 11 starts for the White Sox. They ended up with 84 wins. They didn't make it to the playoffs and all that. But, you know, they were right in that kind of fringe of the hunt, right? Well, Daniel Hudson had made 6 appearances for the White Sox the year before, and then 3 for them that year. But he goes to the D-backs and is immediately put in the rotation, right? And he's the young guy who's not ready, right? That's why they traded for Edwin Jackson, is because Daniel Hudson wasn't ready. And Daniel Hudson goes 7-1, 1.69 ERA with a 3.22 FIP, 3.8 WAR in 11 starts the rest of the year. Daniel Hudson, the rest of that year, was exactly what was better than they ever would have hoped that Edwin Jackson would be for them in the same number of starts, 11 starts, right? So obviously, given hindsight, you would say, well, the White Sox should have held on to the cost-controlled Daniel Hudson and just ridden him to this. But then there's even the context of maybe not, because we don't know, like, again, this is 16 years ago now, but did Daniel Hudson need to go to Arizona, and was there someone there, the pitching coach or whatever, who was able to unlock something in Daniel Hudson that didn't exist before? And so, like, we talk about this at times, like, it's like, we talked about this with Chase Dolander on his way up, right? Like, Jeff and I remember having a prospect podcast. We're talking about him and we're like, we think he could be really good, but we also fully acknowledge that we could be talking about this 8 years from now and say, he never was any good. Why? He pitched to Colorado. So that's where it's like, or you say with a guy like, oh, like, I'll tell you right now, like, you know, we joke about it, but it's like when the draft happens and a guy gets drafted by the Dodgers and you just kind of go like, yep. You know, whereas if I've said before, like, I'm sorry, but Elijah Green and the Nationals of the early 2020s was the worst possible combination of player and farm system to put together, because the Nationals, what Elijah Green needed was plate discipline and contact skills improvement. And that was not things that the Nationals were good at that time. You have both ways can happen, where you can have guys who are a perfect fit for an organization, or you can have guys who are the exact worst possible fit in organization. And sometimes those guys then get moved and it's like, whoa, you know, look what they've got. And sometimes it's like, yeah, but it wouldn't have happened if you didn't manage to fuse that player in that situation. Ian, it looked like you had something to say.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, like, an example of that as someone who kind of strikes who fits that for me right now in the 100 is Christian Zazueta. You know, this was a guy who was with the Yankees, didn't have a ton of experience with the Yankees, but, you know, he was a DSL repeater. And, you know, the track record of DSL repeaters is probably getting better, but it's not the best. He gets traded in a kind of a minor deal for, I think it was Caleb Ferguson, you know, solid, what, sixth inning, you know, middle relief type. And he's gone to the Dodgers, and it took him, you know, it took a year or so, but now all of a sudden he's really taken off. And you look at his last two seasons, and now he's someone who I think will probably, I wouldn't be surprised if he continues to rise up the 100. You know, he's, you know, just completely exploded. And, you know, would that have happened with the Yankees? I don't know. You know, it took, as I said, he was in the DSL for two seasons, but the Dodgers clearly saw something that they could work with. And I think that's what makes it, especially with pitchers, I really care about the organization they're in and the archetype of pitcher they are and how it fits in that organization. Because you look, I think there's a pretty strong track record of certain orgs of developing pitchers, you know, the Dodgers, the Brewers, the Guardians. I mean, the Red Sox are starting to kind of turn into that a little bit. Like, there are certain orgs that when they acquire a pitcher, especially if they come in with a baseline talent level, it really piques your interest for me now. And I think that's something that too, like, can kind of influence the 100. Cause I look at some of the pitchers and it's like, you know, as you said, Chase Dolander, if Chase Dolander was on one of those other orgs, I feel like he probably would have ranked a lot higher than he did with the Rockies. Cause just inherently, unfortunately, if you're in Colorado, it's really hard to be a pitcher there. And so I think it's just, there's so many contextual factors that go into these things.
Jeff, you get to wrap it up. You get the final thoughts. What else strikes you?
Oh, just about the entire list.
Yeah, the process, because we've been talking a lot about, you know, again, the challenges. And I say that in a good way. Like, again, the challenges in a we wanted this to be better every year. We try to get better at it. But what are the things that you see as kind of things that we're trying to get better at?
I think the biggest challenge is players who perform well, kind of check all the boxes throughout all the levels of the minors, and then they get the AAA and struggle. Because we've seen guys.
Can I interject?
Sure.
I would even throw out the even more challenging one is this. I think Mark Chiarelli on our staff talked to a scout about this guy. It's like, there are also now guys like Jack Caglione who dominate every level of the minors. And I remember the scout saying right before he came up, he's like, he needs to be sent to the majors. He's going to get his head handed to him.
Yeah.
It's the only way he's going to learn how to be a good player because the minors won't do it. So you got that to go to it too.
Sorry. Yeah. I just hope they get to 130 at bats or 45 days of service time in a relatively quick fashion and struggle then and then figure it out. That happens too. But I don't know. I feel like the Colson Montgomery example is one that kind of sticks in my mind. I was thinking about it the other day where I kind of always believed in the power. I believed in the athlete. We tried to hold on with Colson Montgomery through probably over a year of struggles in AAA. I mean, if you look at his AAA numbers, he just did not produce. And then kind of they shut him down. They reworked the swing. He came back. We started to see some positive stuff. I don't know if we had added him back into the top 100 at that point. He had just fallen off. Like we kept him on there for, if he struggled for 15 months, we kept him on there for 13 or 14. And then he gets up to the majors and he's running these high whiff rates and like kind of chase rates, but he's finding barrels. He's making plays in the field. And it's like, all right, like there's a lot to buy into still here. And I think like that's the biggest struggle. And I think we see it with a lot of West Coast pitchers in AAA too, guys that, you know, are really good. And then they go to the Pacific Coast League and they struggle. And I think AAA kind of in general is like this, but particularly the Pacific Coast League. And you're like, I don't know if this is indicative of the struggles he's going to have in the major leagues, or if it's just some PCL weirdness of, you know, the way the run environments are there. So I find AAA harder and harder to kind of evaluate because there's just maybe less so this year prior to the challenge system coming to MLB. But like, I can remember like everybody when it was like full ABS and then they had that like mid, what was it? It was like Tuesday to Thursday, yeah, it was ABS, yeah. And then it was challenge system from Friday to Sunday or vice versa.
Yes.
And like, we saw so many guys that really weren't, remember Ellie De La Cruz sticks in my head, but we saw so many guys that really didn't walk a whole lot, that didn't have great approaches, that all of a sudden had like 11, 12% walk rates in AAA. And it was like, I don't know if I can buy that. And it was like, all right, so maybe we need to discount some of these walk rates and some of these hitters a little bit from what they're producing in AAA versus maybe like not discounting what some of these pitchers are doing, despite the numbers maybe being, you know, a little bit ugly and a little bit of an eyesore. So I find some of the AAA performance at times a little bit tricky. I mean, it was kind of the thing that was in my head as we were watching, because I was at the same game Ian was this weekend, watching Carson Milbrandt, of like, I like a lot of stuff about this guy, but I don't want to get too caught up in bad AAA performance. I tried to focus more on mechanical things, other things that maybe I didn't like about Milbrandt, that I thought personally were maybe like bigger concerns. And stuff like, I don't cover the Marlins, but stuff that I might discuss when we're going over to the top 100 list with some analysts or front office people, like, hey, what are your thoughts on Milbrandt and like his mechanics and lower half and some of that stuff, as opposed to focusing on, hey, Milbrandt has, you know, whatever his ERA is at the moment over this many starts. And is that a concern? Because I think you tend to get less interesting conversations on that sort of thing, as opposed to maybe like trying to dig in a little deeper and like figure out, all right, like, what is the struggle? What is he getting exposed to? Is it just bad luck, which sometimes happens? Or are there other things like mechanical flaws, et cetera, that are more worthy of kind of digging in deep when I get a really smart person, you know, on the phone or via text message or whatever?
I'll just throw off that. Like you mentioned Montgomery, like, okay, the White Sox are fascinating this year. But like, if you take Colson Montgomery and Munetaka Murakami, and if you ask me right now, are these going to be star players in 27 and 28? Are they going to be solid regulars? Or are they going to be guys where we're kind of scratching our head and go, what happened? I think all three of those are very plausible answers for both of those. Because like Colson Montgomery, at the end of the day, is a good defensive shortstop who hits the ball really hard and is probably going to run 220, 230 batting averages, 290 OB, 300 OBPs. And it's like, that's where that borderline is really close of like, let's say that all of a sudden what happened to the baseball next year? And it's like, okay, just carve, you know, 5 to 8 homers off of everyone. Well, then all of a sudden he becomes less valuable. Murakami has been incredible this year when healthy. And then there's the other part of it where it's like, how many guys have long-term success striking out 32% of the time? Where it's like, again, this is where we're talking about big leaguers. We're not even talking about prospects. And I think that if you ask me to make the argument on all three of those cases, I think I could make a convincing argument. You know, I know I saw your eyes get big because I know you and I've talked about Murakami. It's like, is this the sign of a new archetype of player that can make it work? Or is this a really good 300 plate appearances?
Yeah, I mean, it was something I brought up in a conversation with Ian today as we're talking through some of the fantasy ranks that we're updating and going to go on the site today. And it's like, you know, I don't really know what to do with Lazaro Montes because it is 80 power. There's great angles there. Like, is this another guy that could pull a Murakami? It's not an unheard of profile, but it does seem like these guys are finding a little bit more impact. And I don't think it's just like power. I think it's like their batting averages, their on-base percentages seem to be running a little bit higher than they would have years ago.
We're almost an hour in, so we don't need to dive into this, but it's like, the fascinating thing with guys like that is that like, those are the guys who their range of spectrum of outcomes is so wide because like, I can tell you right now, there's never going to be a point in Lazaro Montes' career where he can't be beat by quality stuff. Like, that's going to be absolutely true. But the difference between a guy like that, like, when we talk about the Nick Madrigal type, like, archetype, never swings and never misses and all this, but can do nothing when to do it. Like, your range of what you can do is really small because it's going to be a batting average derived value with a little bit of walks, but you're pretty aggressive, so it's not that. The difference with Lazaro Montes is going to be, does he square up 3 balls a week, 2 balls a week, 1 ball a week, you know, like 5 balls a week? Like, and it's going to be very narrow margins because like the difference, like he's going to swing and miss a lot at pitches in the zone. But as you just said, like he's also going to hit enough of them. Like, if he gets to, again, we're talking about Murakami, right? Murakami swings a ton and misses. But if you can get to 30 homers doing it, 40 homers doing it, who cares? And that's, again, it's a fun topic. This was kind of our preview. Next week, we will talk about the actual tangible top 100. Especially, we'll probably talk a lot about what we did at the top of that. But we hope you did enjoy this kind of look at kind of the bigger picture. Again, we love doing this. This is why we, you know, the three of us on this have gone to a whole lot of games over the years and been thinking about this for a very long time. We're fortunate we get to do that. Thank you, Baseball America subscribers. Speaking of that, there is going to be an offer. If you're not a Baseball America subscriber, do check out later this week on the site. We will have an offer tied to the trade deadline where you can save on a new subscription. So check that out. Do check out the live show that Ian and I will do Wednesday evening. That is July 29th, trade deadline live show, 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific. And also, obviously, check out over at baseballamerica.com. When trades happen, we're going to write them up. When it comes to prospects, we're going to rank every prospect traded, and we're also giving you a lot of historical information on that. And by the way, we got everything about, you know, wrapping up the draft. We've got everything getting ready for the next draft. We've got the high school rankings, recruiting rankings, all that over at baseballamerica.com. For Jeff, for Ian, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.